Attorney Holly Draper is bringing Girl Power to the Pressure Tested podcast. We'll be chatting about her all-female remote work law firm and how the Clifton personality test helped her become an entrepreneur. Holly, thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule to be here for this podcast. We are super excited to have you. I have so many questions, but we're going to see where the conversation goes. First off, for our listeners that don't know you, how did you get started practicing law?
So when I was young, I always wanted to be a lawyer. And about middle school, I changed my mind and I loved sports. I went to college wanting to do sports marketing, advertising for sports teams, majored in advertising, then switched to public relations, went and did an internship at the Orange Bowl and absolutely hated it. I was like, any idiot off the street could do this job. This is not what I want to spend my life doing. And while I was there, I ended up connecting with someone who was a law student at the University of Miami, who was also volunteering at the Orange Bowl. And we started talking about law school and the law. I was like, why did I change my mind? Whatever made me decide not to pursue that path? Because it really seemed like the path I was born to follow. And so then I started working at a little tiny law firm in Lubbock, where I was at Texas Tech. And next thing you know, I was in law school at UT, and here we are.
Wow, that's awesome. So you graduated from college in 2004?
I graduated from college in 2001 and from law school in 2004.
Okay. And what did you do right out of law school?
I spent 4 years out of law school at a mid-sized civil defense firm in Dallas. I was doing product liability defense during that time. Lost my job in the 2008 economy crash. And I'd always wanted to have my own business, have my own firm, but I felt like I need X number of dollars in the bank. I need Y number of clients to go with me. I need to be done having kids, all these things. I had none of those. And then that just gave me the push that I needed. And I decided, you know what? It's now or never. And about 15 years later, still going strong.
Wow. That's amazing. That's got to be a tough decision. And so what were you considering going back to other law firms? What was like the final thing that you just said, this is it. This is why I'm going to do this.
So this happened right after I had my first child. So I had a baby at home and I was actively looking for other law firm jobs, but somebody that I hadn't seen in many years, a parent of somebody that I grew up with, just so happened to reach out to me right at that time. Had no idea that I'd lost my job and said, hey, my daughter's company needs a lawyer. They don't want to hire a lawyer. They need a lawyer to give business to. And it was collections work, something totally different than I do now, but it was something that fell into my lap that let me have the confidence to feel like, okay, I'm going to have some money coming in right out of the gates. So the timing was just perfect. So it was probably only a week and a half maybe after I lost my job that I launched my firm.
Wow, that's amazing. I think that some people spend years wanting to start their own business and you did it in a week and a half. That's very impressive. So you've got this super successful law firm. Tell me about Draper Law Firm.
So I started out as a true solo, just me. You know, I was the one answering the phone. I was the one setting hearings. I was the one doing everything. And when I started out, it was a little bit of everything. I felt like I have to take whatever walks through the door, can't turn down business. And I did a lot of different things. And over time, family law started walking through the door. And I'd do a divorce here and there. And then it became more and more. And I realized I really loved it. When I went to law school, I wanted to be a litigator. I wanted to be a trial lawyer in the courtroom. When I went to a litigation firm, I was never in the courtroom. I reviewed a lot of documents. I did a lot of, sat out at vehicle inspections. I was not doing what I had gone to law school to do. I didn't think I wanted to do family law in law school because I thought, why would you want to be messed up in people's lives like that? So I didn't even take it in law school. And then when I started doing it more and more, I eventually started to niche down and probably became exclusively family law probably 5 years into having my firm.
Okay.
Did a little bit of dabbling in estate planning until maybe 5 years ago, but found that niche over time. And now I'm board certified in family law and that's all we do.
So how long after you started your firm did you get to the point where you were like, okay, I can't take on any more personally and I'm going to have to hire another attorney?
So the first person I hired was kind of an admin, you know, person to answer the phone and all those things. And eventually I was very afraid of hiring an attorney because you feel like they're very expensive. And so I started out just dabbling in it a little bit with somebody who was kind of starting her own firm and she was doing some contract work for me. And then the more work she started to do for me, I finally realized, okay, I can actually hire this person as an employee. And now she's a partner in the firm and we have 4 other lawyers that work for us besides me and her. And I'm a huge fan of hiring lawyers because I want to be able to travel the world. I want to be able to, you know, cherry pick which cases I handle at this point in my career. And having other lawyers there means they can go to mediation. They can go to court. They can do all of the things that I would need to do if I just had paralegals or support staff.
And what's funny about that and how you're able to do that, I think that there's all kinds of businesses where there's an owner who's not willing to let go of the control and not willing to fully trust their employees to do these jobs. I know that you're a really big fan of having a good work-life balance. You've had that for a long time. So how did you learn to trust them to be as good as you are in the courtroom or as good as you are at representing one of your clients?
I think part of it is realizing that they're probably not going to be as good as
okay,
as good as you are, but that's okay.
Yeah.
And they need to be good and they need to be good enough so that they can do a good job representing the clients and get the job done.
Yeah. But let's get to the real. How did you handle it when you had, you know, your first couple of lawyers working for you and they didn't do the job that you wanted them to do? How did you teach? How did you coach them to be better?
That's something, it's definitely a learning process of how to manage, how to lead, and how not to get super angry if something goes wrong, you know, not to lose it on them, yeah. Help them learn, especially if they're a young lawyer. And that's part of the process. They're going to make mistakes. They're going to learn. How do you teach them? How do you train them, grow them into the lawyer that you want them to be? Over the years, I've had a number of lawyers work for me that were, some were super experienced, some were had very little experience and everything in between. And I definitely realized that it's better to have somebody on the low to mid-level experience mm-hmm. than somebody who's really set in their ways. Because
definitely
we want things to be done a certain way. And they're much easier to train when they're not already, they haven't been doing it for years and years and years.
Yeah, that's smart.
So, and I work with a business coach, and that's made a huge difference for me and, leadership training and what books I should be reading or what podcasts I should listen to and coming up with systems and how to implement the things that I want across the board amongst the team.
I think that's great. I think that's another place where business owners or C-suites will really struggle because they get to a point where they don't feel like they need to be coachable. And then when they are coachable and they hire a coach or a consultant to come in and really help, it can change everything for them. But it takes a certain breed of human to be willing to be coachable, I think. And that definitely shows with your firm. One of the really cool things that I love about your firm, one of the first things I noticed is you only have women working for you. I love that.
Yeah, now we've grown. We have 12 people total working in the firm, 6 lawyers, a law clerk, 3 paralegals. Actually, no, we're down to 2 paralegals now. So to 11 people working in the firm, but they're all women. And I think it's because of the culture that I've created, which is, you know, it was very important to me that I'd be able to be both a great lawyer and business owner and a great mom and be there for my kids and have a really good work-life balance. And I've seen a lot of places where that is not the case. And so I really strive to give that to my employees and to create an environment where they can do both and not feel like they're failing one or the other at all times. Hmm.
And it's not that I wouldn't hire a man, but typically whenever I put something out there, you know, looking for people to apply, it's generally women that are applying. So
I love that. I think that, and so one of the things about your firm that I think probably attracts that, and because it as a, you know, as a professional woman myself, I constantly have that struggle. Like my daughter right now is struggling with reading and I'm like, oh my gosh, like how I'm not performing as a mom because my daughter is struggling with something. And it's really difficult to not to be too hard on yourself with that. But something that you've come up with at your firm that isn't, you know, it's a, what a lot of people do, but you said on a podcast that you were virtual before virtual was cool. So tell me a little bit about your decision to have all of your team be virtual.
So I started out being primarily virtual. Over the years, I've had, you know, a little office here or there, but I've basically been virtual since I started in 2008. And at the time, it was mostly about overhead. And it was also about, you know, being able to be there when my kids left for school, be there when my kids got home from school. Before COVID, we didn't know how to Zoom. We didn't know what Zoom was. But you can have an inexpensive phone consult, or you can have a much more expensive office consult. If I'm going to have to, you know, drive into the office, get dressed up, go meet with you and drive back, it's going to take a lot more time than a 30-minute phone call. Well, now with after COVID, everybody knows how to Zoom. It's become so common in society that there's zero reason that people need to meet. Very few reasons people actually need to meet in person. And we've really taken the position that we will meet in person if I think we need to meet in person. We don't need to meet in person for a consult. We can do it over Zoom or we can do it over the phone, whichever one you prefer. But I find most people appreciate it because it takes less time out of their day. They don't have to take a whole half day off of work to go have a 30-minute consultation or an hour-long consultation with a lawyer. They just have to spend that hour.
Yeah. You know, we have a statistic that remote workers are 13% more productive than their in-office counterparts. And you spoke to this a little bit about on a recent podcast that you feel like your team is more efficient working at home.
I was nervous about it at first. And my first hires were, this was pre-COVID, you know, people that I already knew.
Okay.
I was afraid to hire people that were complete strangers, the traditional way of hiring, just because how do I trust that they're going to get the work done? But now I think working from home has become super commonplace and it doesn't take long to figure out if somebody's getting their work done or not.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of ways of, you know, we communicate with Slack, we'll have Zoom meetings. And if somebody's expected to be working at a certain time, they haven't marked themselves out or whatever, I better be able to reach you.
Absolutely.
During that time.
Yeah.
So I think people are, you have to have the right kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had attorneys in the past or people in the past who found it to be too isolating and they struggled with their mental health because they were not around people all the time.
Yep.
So, you know, this is one of the questions I always ask whenever anybody interviews. Have you ever worked virtually? How do you feel about this? Because some people can't handle it. It's not good for them. I love it. I love being able to work in my yoga pants and a t-shirt and hang out with my dogs and, you know, throw a little laundry in between my meetings or whatever.
Yeah, that's nice.
And it just, I feel like it makes my life more efficient.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's very personality based. And also just if people have the experience of working from home, I think that when you get to a certain level of professionalism, you have to be self-motivated. If you're not self-motivated, you're probably not going to do well anywhere in office or at home. But I'm with you that it takes the right kind of person because I've never really worked remote. We were home from COVID for 2 weeks and then back in the office. And I've realized that on days that I am home, I'm more tempted to spend the day doing laundry or just, my boss is probably going to hear this, but I'm just more tempted to, you know, do other things. It's hard for me to sit down and want to really work because my body's not used to being at home working. I'm used to being in the office working. So I definitely think there's a shift to it. But, you know, and I'm sure you get asked this all the time, but how do you maintain culture and how do you drive these core values and create this, you know, type of workplace where people feel connected by just having everybody remote?
So a few ways we really try and do it. We only hire locally remote so that we can get together in person from time to time. You know, we have a quarterly fun Friday so that everybody can get together in person. Last time we went to the Ranger game and everybody could bring their families. And we've done, you know, a wreath making party and Top Golf. Mm-hmm. And we just do different things every quarter to get together. And then we'll get together periodically. Like last week we had a photo shoot. And so we all went to the photo shoot and then we all went out to dinner afterwards so that people can get that personal connection. And we'll have Zoom meetings. We kind of function in teams. And so I'll have a Zoom meeting with every team that I work with every week so that we are making sure that we're on top of cases and all that. And I'm always, you know, you don't want to just waste time, but we always make sure to have a little bit of chit chat, you know, what's going on with your kids? What are you doing for, you know, the weekends? Just so that you're having that personal connection beyond just the work.
Definitely. I think that's super important. I wanted to talk to you about, and it's so silly. People get so focused on what they're doing with their own lives. I've never really even thought about women versus men owned law firms. And so we pulled some statistics. And so women owned law firms in 2020, the American Bar Association said this, that they grew at a 6% volume versus male owned firms at 3%. But at the same time, the average billable rate for a woman-owned firm is $250, while a man-owned firm is $300. So how have you had to deal with that? Do you have any pushback on your billable rate? How have you determined your billable rate? How does all of that work?
So I think there's kind of two pieces to that, one being the higher rate of growth of women-owned firms. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of women are seeking that balance and they can't find it in a traditional law firm.
Okay.
And so that causes so many women to get out that don't want to give up the practice of law to go out and start their own firm. You know, in terms of billable rates, it is definitely, I think, what's the right word? Imposter syndrome, where you think, I can't charge that. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of women suffer from that. And, you know, I will regularly try and find out from other attorneys that are kind of comparable to myself, what they're billing at, what are their associates billing at. I mean, we'll see fee agreements from other firms in most cases because those things get exchanged. So you always know kind of what the market is doing. But I mean, at our firm, it's you'll have lower level associates at a much lower billable rate than me. And that makes it, okay, you're going to get my expertise on your case, but you're going to have most of the work being done by someone that's half the rate.
I think that's a really good lead in to, I was listening to the Wealthy Woman Lawyer podcast. That's a fun podcast. And you said that basically when people come to you and they make demands of your firm, they say, you know, Holly, I want you on this case. I'm coming to this firm because I want you to do it. You kind of give some pushback on that. And I want to talk about that. Like, how do you feel comfortable giving that pushback?
So that definitely gets easier to do over time and the more successful that your business is. And, you know, I'm able to say, you know, you hired my firm, not me. You hired the firm, just like your friend who raved about our firm hired our firm, not me. And that, you know, I don't do a ton of litigation anymore. I'm focusing more on appeals. So people call in constantly wanting to consult with me. And we have gatekeepers and, our intake people will say, sorry, she's doing appeals right now, but you can consult with this person, this other attorney who is handling that type of case in Collin County. Every once in a while, an intake person will reach out to me and say, hey, this person called. They really want to consult with you. This is what's going on. This is who referred them. And I'll say either yes or no, depending on the situation. But I find, and maybe it's because I have enough gatekeepers in between who deal with the pushback that I don't get a ton of it. I very much, like, this is my business. I've built it into something extremely successful. And if you want to work with us, this is what we do. And you can, if you don't like it, there's plenty of other firms that do things differently. For example, nobody has my cell phone. They're not, you can call in and get the main line and leave a message probably for me and we'll schedule a time for me to talk to you unless it's an emergency. And then they, you know, reach out to me accordingly. But you email me at 6 o'clock on a Friday night, I'm not going to respond to you until Monday. I'm probably not even going to see it until Monday.
Wow.
It's just, you know, we try and lay out the expectations. We have not like onboarding guide that goes out to clients right at the beginning of this is how things work in our firm so that people know what to expect. And then we stick to it.
Well, I think two things from that. The first being, I bet you weed out so many just weirdos or narcissists by being, hey, these are the rules and we're going to stick to them. So I think that's great. Like, do you think that that happens? Do you think that you have a lot of kind of the wild people calling in, especially over family law cases? And do you think some of these levels you've put into place help you kind of steer clear of those guys?
Oh, absolutely. And you want to steer clear of those people. Yep. Because they make your life stressful and miserable, and nobody, you know, we do not want to live like that. You know, our intake people have very detailed red flag lists, and they have things they're supposed to listen for in those calls.
Nice.
You know, you mentioned the word narcissist. Everybody is married to a narcissist that's getting a divorce without fail. And the times they use the word narcissist, the worse of a client they are going to be. So that's one of the red flags on the list.
That's fun. Like, that's fun.
And I'll get intake notes, and it'll say in all caps, like, narcissist alert. And so that's just one example. Another example, you know, have they had multiple attorneys before us? Mm-hmm. That's a huge red flag, because probably the problem was them and not the attorneys.
Yep.
So just things like that. And we've been able to really cut down. Now, a crazy or horrible client does slip through the cracks every once in a while, and sometimes we'll have to withdraw once we figure that out. But we do a pretty good job of...
Yeah, I imagine some of them disguise themselves pretty well initially. Oof, it's a lot. Okay, so that really makes me think about how, so when you, you know, when I found out you practice family law, I really started thinking about what would it be like to, you know, have such a responsibility to a family to, you know, help a court decide who the parent is that should get custody or who gets what in a divorce. I mean, but the child, like a child is going to live with the person that the court decides, and you have such a role in that. How do you keep your emotions out of it?
That is definitely key to being in family law for very long. If you let it get to you, you are not going to survive in this profession. Sort of like being a doctor.
Okay.
You can't get too personally invested. You have to care, because if you don't care, what are you doing?
Right.
But you can't care too much, because then it becomes your problem and it's not your problem.
Wow.
You know, we're very settlement-minded and think that most people are going to be better off if they can reach reasonable agreements.
Mm-hmm.
Not everything can be settled. Sometimes you have to go to court, but it's kind of about knowing when it's appropriate and when it's not. What's worth fighting for in court and what is not. You know, most of the time when you're in court, it's like, all right, we're talking about 52-48 versus 40, you know, 48-52 for custody, and it's not really a life-altering thing. But sometimes you've got abuse allegations, or you have something that I don't know if it happened.
Yeah.
I just know what my client says happened. There's not really – it's he said, she said, or sometimes there's an expert, a counselor, somebody who's raising concerns. And, you know, there are occasionally cases that will keep you up at night, and – a lot of lawyers get out of doing contested litigation because they have too many cases that keep them up at night.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully, there's only a handful over the years that have truly been the type to keep me up at night. Because otherwise, I mean, you get burned out really fast.
Yeah. I mean, I can't even imagine. Like, I feel like I'm pretty good about keeping my emotions out of work. But I just think about these kids and these people that have made these promises to each other. I couldn't do the separation. So I admire you for that. I think that it takes someone a lot more strong-minded than I am to be able to separate that. But you mentioned abuse allegations. And so I have done my homework, and I have read about Starry versus Etheridge, and I've read about your other Supreme Court case to the best of my unlegal mind. So I would love to talk to you about Starry versus Etheridge and just Explain to us what that case is about, and then what are the ramifications of, you know, this going from the Texas Supreme Court and U.S. law for U.S. family law?
So I was not the trial attorney in this case. Okay. So a lot of times when you do appeals, you know, somebody does it at the trial court level, and then you come in and you're just reading a very cold record.
Okay.
And that's what the Court of Appeals or the Texas Supreme Court will read. So in this particular case, there was a judge. So Houston, Harris County, has a protective order specific court. And normally, if you're here, you know, Dallas, Collin, wherever, most counties, if you're going to have a divorce and there's a domestic violence allegation, those protective order and divorce are going to be heard by the same judge.
Okay.
In Harris County, the protective order gets split off to this protective order only judge. And this one particular judge was on the bench, handed out protective orders like candy. Wow. Thankfully, this judge is not on the bench anymore, but this judge was on the bench when Staria versus Etheridge was in the trial court.
Okay.
And, you know, I read this record transcript, and it's shocking how little evidence there was.
Yep.
It was, you know, kindergarten teacher mom, and dad was seeking a protective order against mom mm-hmm. based on allegations of abuse. And the thing with protective orders, civil protective orders have a relatively low standard,
right?
That a burden that you have to meet, as opposed to a criminal case. You got to prove everything beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a very high burden, as it should be, to keep people out of prison unless right. they really belong there.
Right.
Similarly, in a CPS or a termination case, could be CPS, could be private. You know, in order under the family code to terminate someone's parental rights, it's a very high burden. You have to prove it by what's called clear and convincing evidence.
Okay.
Not quite as high as beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's a high burden.
Okay.
Usually those cases are going to take a year. There's going to be a lot of discovery. Your trial is going to last a day, two, three, a week. There's a lot of opportunity to defend yourself. With a protective order, the standard is just a preponderance of the evidence. So that means 51%. It's just tipping the scales just a touch on the side of one way or the other to
okay.
prove something by preponderance of the evidence. And when you file for a protective order, the statute requires that you have a hearing either within 14 or 20 days, depending okay. on the size of your county. No time to do discovery. If someone
wow.
has pending criminal charges, more often than not, their criminal lawyer is going to say, you're not allowed to testify. So they can't defend themselves.
Hmm.
They have to take the Fifth. That did not happen in Starry,
right.
but it happens in a lot of protective order cases. So it's much easier to get a protective order than it is to get a criminal conviction or termination under the family code. The protective order statute says you can get a protective order for longer than 2 years, up to a lifetime, if there's an allegation the person committed a felony.
Okay. Yep.
But it's just an allegation. It does not require charges.
Hmm.
It does not require a conviction. It doesn't require proof of the felony by anything more than a preponderance of the evidence.
And what does that mean, preponderance of the evidence?
That's just the 51%.
Okay.
So we'll talk about like a scale. If you're weighting a scale
yeah.
and it just tips it just
there's so there's a chance it happened, kind of.
You know, you think it's more likely than not that it
okay.
happened.
All right,
but only
you.
51% is all that's required. So in Starry, you know, I read this record and I'm like, it was based almost entirely mm-hmm. on what the dad said
yeah.
happened. He didn't witness any of it.
Jesus.
It was all based on what the, you know, he's saying the kid said, but that's hearsay, really.
Yep.
And the judge let everything in for the dad. Judge let nothing in for the mom. It was shocking to me
yeah.
to read this. So we are arguing that it is a violation of mom's constitutional rights, because essentially dad got a lifetime protective
right.
order as to the kids.
Yeah.
So with a hearing that was, I don't know, an hour or two long, no opportunity to discovery, and her kids are taken away for life.
That's insane.
And so we're arguing that's a violation of her constitutional rights, because there's no due process
right.
to, like there is with a termination case or with a criminal case. And there's a recent case out of the Fifth Circuit, which is the federal circuit that covers Texas mm-hmm. called Rahimi that said you cannot take away someone's Second Amendment right to own guns in a civil protective order. Mm-hmm. So I have relied a lot on that
yep.
case. Like, okay. if you can't take away someone's guns with a protective order, civil yep. protective order,
you can't take
you
away
certainly
kids.
Shouldn't be away, able to take away their children.
Wow. That's good. Yeah.
So went to the Court of Appeals and unfortunately did not win the Court of Appeals. We got a majority and a dissent. So two justices ruled against us. One justice ruled in our favor. Okay. And now we are pending in the Texas Supreme Court. So hopefully they will take our case. The other side doesn't seem too interested in filing a response. They keep asking over and over and over. Mm-hmm. He doesn't care. He's not going to respond. So hopefully that will not prevent the court from taking our case.
Wow, this is nuts. I mean, it's really as if somebody, like you marry somebody, you have kids, and they decide to change completely, and they decide to make allegations against you. They can somehow convince someone to take your kids away forever. Like, that is just blows my mind. Yeah, that's the kind of thing that would probably keep me up at night, for sure. I think most of these things would keep me up at night. But this one would for sure. So you said a couple of times that you read it. So how did you end up with this case?
So a lawyer, the trial lawyer for the mom, reached out to me because she knew me from my other Texas Supreme Court case.
Okay.
Very and good. Referred that appeal to me.
Wow. Amazing. So the level of responsibility that rests on your shoulders to, I mean, really just set a whole law in motion on how something, I mean, it's a lot. So kudos to you. Cause I think that you handle it. Cause you said something earlier and I thought it was really interesting. I will just out of sheer habit check my emails maybe once an hour on vacation, on Sunday, on Saturday. And it's not so much that I'm constantly have to know what's going on. It's almost like a bad habit almost. But you said that 5 o'clock on Friday, if I email you, you may not see it till Monday. How do you do that?
Well, I might see it, but I'm not going to respond
to
it.
Yeah, there you go. That's funny. That's tough. Especially when you have a case like that.
Well, on an appeal,
yeah.
The timelines are really spread out. There's cool. It's not like litigation where things can happen really quickly
right. Or
there could be an emergency that we got to deal with right then. There's not an emergency to be dealt with. It's a waiting game. And when you're writing briefs, you know, you have 30 days, 60 days, maybe longer. So it's a slow process.
I just think I love when things just completely go against the norm. And I think that society has created this idea where you have to work all the time. You have to constantly be connected. And that's the only way you're going to win. That's the only way you're going to be successful. And I love when someone can just absolutely prove that wrong. Somebody can come in and say, no, I have an excellent work-life balance. I'm still killing it. So, you know, essentially screw you and your ideas.
Well, I know a lot of people who are partners at other more traditional family law firms, and they work a ton.
Yeah.
And I tell them all the time, like, you're doing it wrong, man.
Yeah, they are.
My goal is work less, make more.
Yeah.
And to do that, you got to have people below you that are doing the legwork.
So here's the one thing that I just consistently see with your character. This is me, you know, using my deductive skills to, you know, figure out what makes you tick. And I think that something that I just really admire about you is you are the ultimate risk taker. You just take the risk. And how do you have the courage to always take the risk, to take the high profile case, to start the law firm? How do you do that?
I don't know. I think it's partly personality.
Yep.
You know, I grew up with a dad that was owned his own business, entrepreneur, and I probably wouldn't have taken the risk to start my own firm, but for losing my job, at least not when I did it, because I'm the breadwinner in my house and we weren't sitting on a big pile of money. Mm-hmm. So I had to get a little push to take that risk.
Okay.
But I think the more successful you become, the easier it becomes to take risks.
Yeah, that's good. I am the opposite of a risk taker, by the way. I tread lightly on all situations. Okay, so I want to talk to you about Facebook. So I am friends with you on Facebook, and I am always really impressed by the stuff that you post. And what I mean by that is you may post something about the school board election, and you are the, you know, you're the neighborhood expert on what's going on with that school board election. And then the next week, you're going to post that you've been wearing the same Revlon lipstick for 15 years and that you need somebody to spam you on how to update your beauty routine. And so you're so comfortable being the expert, but you're also comfortable posting something vulnerable. And I'm just curious, like, you are 100% uniquely you on social media. How did you get there? I mean, I'm scared to post anything. I mean, they're not going to like it. They're not going to think I'm smart. Where does that courage come from?
So I have definitely mastered Facebook for business purposes. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say like the business page, which I have, but yeah. Social networking and connecting with people and being an influencer. Mm-hmm. It was interesting when I started working with a business coach. One of the things she had me do was called the Clifton Strengths Analysis. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know what that is, it's like a sort of like a personality testing. And everything falls into one of four categories: influencing, strategic thinking, relationship building, and executing. And my coach was kind of like, I've never seen this before. It's like all your top ones are all influencing.
Interesting.
And it was influencing strategic thinking. I learned through this process, I'm a terrible executor and I'm terrible at relationships. So, you know, my law partner is really great at the relationship building and she has different strengths than I do. And so, but I kind of leaned into the influencing after having learned that, but I've always been really good at, you know, networking those Facebook moms groups and things like that. It's probably a more recent trend of posting things on social media that people seem to really care about.
Yeah.
Like I reviewed a bunch of banned books when that all was going on in our district.
Oh yeah, I followed that.
And mm-hmm. I just recently posted something about the vouchers and the TEA accountability lawsuits and stuff.
Yep.
And I go on, look at that. I'm like, wow, this has been shared almost 700 times.
Wow.
How many thousands of people have read this diatribe that I wrote about the TEA lawsuits? And I had people reaching out like, you should run for the school board. I'm like, I don't think I want to do that. But it's kind of about learning what your strengths are and then leaning into those.
Absolutely.
Instead of, you know, for example, I'm a poor executor.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a podcast. I don't do any of it myself except record the episodes. I pay someone else to do all of it.
That's good.
Because if I have to execute it myself, it's not going to happen. So, or, you know, I probably could stand to work a little bit on my relationship building. I try to work on that a little bit. But
no, I love that. I love Clifton StrengthsFinder. I think that people get lost in this idea that when they're bad at something, they should work hard at getting better at it, and they focus less on the things they're already good at. But imagine what you've done with Facebook, because you found out what your strength was and you focused on it. And I think that that's exactly what that book was written for and why everybody should do that. I've really pushed to try to get people here at Moss to take it. I'm with you on that. I think I was like all strategic thinking, zero relationship building, not great at the execution. I'm like, just give me a problem. I'll solve it, but I'm going to need somebody else to do all the work once I solve it. Okay, so another cool thing you post on Facebook is all your travel. And I think your travel is interesting because, so my family, we've gotten in this bad habit of kind of taking all the same vacations over and over again. So, you know, come June, we're going to 30A, we're going to stay at the same place, we're going to go to the same restaurant, we're going to sit on the beach. We love it. It's like it's our little comfort zone. And while I'm in 30A, you're in Egypt or Australia or Costa Rica or doing something just crazy adventurous. So where does that motivation come from?
So I mentioned my dad was an entrepreneur and it was a pre-cell phone, pre-internet era. And so when I was growing up, we only went places that we could drive, and he could pull over every 3 hours to a gas station on the side of the road and call into his business. And my mom always wanted to travel, and he would just say, when I retire. Well, he died of cancer at the age of 60, and so he didn't make it to retirement.
Wow.
And thankfully, I'm in a financial position where I can afford to travel. And it's ramped up a lot. At first, we did a lot more on a budget when we started this. But, you know, my kids are now they're 15 and 13. We started this when they were about 8 and 10. So five-ish years of travel. And, you know, 1 year we had a Christmas. It's probably 2017. Excessive. All the gifts. Mm-hmm. Ridiculous amount of money spent. They got everything they could have asked for and more.
Yeah.
And somebody came over the next day and asked my kids what they got for Christmas, and they couldn't remember a single thing. And we just looked at each other and like, why are we doing this? Let's spend this money on experiences and seeing the world. So that's when we started traveling. We usually do about 4 big trips a year.
Wow.
We've done Australia. We've done Mediterranean cruise, Greece and Italy cruise. We've done Paris, London, Egypt.
Wow.
Alaska, Hawaii. All trying to, we don't go back to the same place.
That's amazing.
It's like, how do I know you're from Prosper? Because you go to 30-acre vacation. I mean, everybody, that is where they go. And my teenage daughter, she just wears me out with, why can't we go to Seaside? Like, I'm sorry, we're going to Greece. And like, I guarantee you every single one of your friends is going to Seaside for the 10th time, which is that they were going to Greece.
They need the t-shirts. You gotta, just tell her you're ordering the t-shirts online.
I did get her, the year we went to Hawaii that she complained we didn't go to Seaside, I got her a shirt that said, I'd rather be in Florida.
Oh my gosh.
I couldn't get her to wear it though on our trip.
That's funny. That's great. Okay, so basically, when you're not traveling the world, you're not running your own law firm, and you're not being a mom, you are investing in real estate. How the heck did you get into real estate?
So I've always, this probably maybe comes from my dad, I don't know, but I've been the entrepreneur bug and I love to learn. I'm constantly listening to podcasts and constantly reading, but audibling about investing and wealth generation and things like that. And wealthy people own real estate. That is how they accumulate wealth. And so, you know, we've always owned houses and we've kind of flipped one house into the next, up going up every time. But we've also owned several long-term rentals. We've owned a bunch of short-term rentals. And now we're kind of shifting out of the short-term rentals back to long-term rentals, but that's how you accumulate wealth. I've made so much more money in real estate than I ever made just investing in the market or putting money in my 401k. I do those things, but real estate is where you really build wealth.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we're both from Prosper, and I think that kind of the thing to do is to have a short-term rental. And I feel like it's almost like the market's bust a little bit. Like everybody did this. It was the popular thing to do. There was all kinds of social media about it. And now the market's really turned around. So you recently sold both of your, or you had 3 Airbnb short-term rental properties?
So we were in 2 markets. We were in Broken Bow and Galveston. So we've been in, Broken Bow was the first place that we bought, and our first cabin made a fortune.
Mm-hmm.
Best investment ever made by far. And then we flipped that into 2 other cabins, and one of those we made a fortune on. The other one kind of bought at the peak.
Yep.
But just watching the trends there of oversaturation and the infrastructure not keeping up with the level of building and the nightly rates going down, we felt like this is going to go down a lot from the peak. So we ultimately sold both of those. We said we're just going to cash in our winnings and call it a day, and then until we find the next thing to invest in. We have a condo in Galveston as well, which was never the boom that Broken Bow was.
Yeah.
Now we're like, okay, we're going to pick up, try and get deals on some long-term rentals. It's really hard now to cash flow unless you can pay cash.
Yeah.
So with the between interest rates being high and prices are still high, unless you can put 50, 75, 100% down, then it's tough. It's a tough time to get in. But like, there have been other tough times to get in, and those people now are worth a lot more than they were.
That's what's so hard, because you know that if you just take the risk and invest, that something good will come of it. But I feel like every time I get ready to do this, I'm like, I'm going to do this year. I'm on it. I'm spending all my time on Realtor. I'm looking at that.
I do that too.
AirDNA or whatever that they charge like $1,000 a month to look up the market information in one area when I'm just really in it. And then I just feel like the market's already saturated. There's already so many, or the cost of the homes is too high for it to make sense. And I start doing all of the math. I'm like, this just doesn't make sense. So, and this is mostly for me, but what area are you looking in right now? Like it's a little bit in the back of your mind as maybe this is a place that could be the next Broken Bow.
So we're not really well, actually, that's not true.
Always looking.
There's two things that we're kind of looking at.
Okay.
For those in the DFW area, are you familiar with Lake Bodark?
No.
So Lake Bodark is the newest lake to be built in Texas. So it's the first lake in 30 years or 40 years to be built in Texas. It's kind of by Bonham, about an hour and a half to two hours away, depending on what part of the lake you're going from where we live. But there are developments starting to come out there.
Okay.
So, you know, we've got some places in line for some of those.
Okay.
And they had a land sale out there for the very first development. It was wild. There were, I don't know, 100 and something lots. The first phase had 75, I think.
Yeah.
And you had to be there with a check in hand for 10% of these lots, ranging from 200 grand to 900 grand.
Wow.
They sold out in 15 minutes.
Holy smokes.
It was crazy. And so now that I've witnessed that, I'm kind of, okay, let's see what the other opportunities are. But it's going to take many years for it to really be developed. So that's a very long-term game.
Yep.
But we're looking at that as, okay, if you can get in at the beginning, then it has the potential to have a lot of appreciation.
I agree with that.
And then we're also looking for like long-term rentals, probably looking at the Sherman area and some of the suburbs around Sherman, because it's still inexpensive relatively to buy property there. And they're having a new TI plant's being built. There's going to be an influx of people coming there. So that's, you know, we're probably going to be able to pick up a house within the Metroplex at a very steep discount because it's coming through family. So that's going to be our next play.
That's great.
Where it's like, all right, there's no other way to positive cash flow, but we can get this because we can cut out the realtors and I can do the deeds. We don't have to pay anything.
That's good.
And so, you know, we're always looking for how can we find a good deal, or how can we, like, where's the next opportunity for real estate?
Yep. Yeah, it's tough. So with your rental properties, do you think you'll do a property management company, or is that something you feel like you can self-manage?
We self-managed for a while in Broken Bow, and it's certainly feasible. For me, I try to outsource everything I can in my life.
That's good.
Like, well, I'm outsourcing everything else. Why would I do this myself?
Yeah.
So we will definitely always have property management companies. I've certainly learned through this process that they are not all created equal. And so you have to find a good one. Like the company we used in Galveston was horrible. So we're in the process of switching to another one. Probably should have pulled the trigger much sooner with that. But for long-term rentals, it's a pretty reasonable percentage, and it's just not worth the
hassle.
We want it to be as passive as possible.
Sure. Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. I mean, you don't want to be the person that gets the phone call at 10 o'clock that their AC is not working.
Right, or 2 in the morning.
I mean, that'd be terrible.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to do that either. Okay, last question before we wrap. Where do you think you're going to be doing in 10 years? You think you'll still be at Draper Law, or you think you'll be doing something else?
10 years, my kids will probably both be done with college. We've kind of talked about, I've lived my entire life in the Dallas area, with the exception of 4 years at Texas Tech and 3 years at UT for law school. And so I've never gotten to experience anything else.
Okay.
So we would love to live in a foreign country for a period of time.
Okay.
My husband is constantly searching for property in Italy or
Spain
or whatever. So that's kind of our dream is...
Okay.
And now especially as I get out of doing litigation, I could run my business from anywhere with all of the virtual technology that we have. So that's kind of my not so secret anymore goal to get to where I'm just where I just have to come in periodically to handle something here, but I can live somewhere different and experience another culture, another part of the world.
That's amazing. Super cool. That's my my dad retired from Saudi Aramco, and he lived the last 15 years of his life in Thailand. And so I went and visited him on different occasions, and it's wild. It's so different from anything you're used to. I mean, especially when this is all you've seen, you come back and you're like, okay, I've got my fast food. I've got all my nice little conveniences back. Well, Holly, thank you so much for joining me on this podcast. Keep doing what you're doing. I definitely admire you, and I look forward to seeing what Draper Law Firm does.
Well, thank you for having me.